The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, saying, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, June 30th, we present the 33rd in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today...
Well, gentlemen, that's your story. Just get this straight. The Air Force mission in this test is in no sense a mission against the Navy. And it's not an attempt to sink an entire guinea pig fleet. Call it just this. A test of an aerial bomb of the Nagasaki type against a spread formation of naval vessels. The purpose is to provide information to the Navy, the Air Forces, and to the Manhattan Project on damage done by this particular type of bomb.
Our subject for today...
One atom bomb of the Nagasaki type.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Today, the National Hour will concentrate its attention upon the most important news spot on this entire globe. We approach a decisive moment. About 1 hour and a half after the close of this broadcast, we expect to hear the shattering sound of the blast above the warships in Bikini Lagoon. On this planet, every eye is turned, every ear attuned to what will happen at Little Bikini Atoll in the Pacific. By shortwave, we shall hear directly from NBC's reporters on Operation Crossroads. From W.W. Chaplin, Ralph Howard Peterson, George Thomas Foster, and from the men assigned to test the atom bomb. Elmer Peterson will speak to us from NBC San Francisco, our communications control point to Joint Task Force Number 1, far out on the wide expanse of the Pacific.
Regular, Mac, huh? Light on the cream and sugar.
Okay.
Oh, sir, Mac, they can't hold out now. We must have dozens of them things.
Yeah. But is this Hiroshima near Tokyo? Why didn't they hit Tokyo? Hit them right in the breadbasket.
Oh, give them time, Mac. Give them time. Gee, they... Oh, hi, Charlie.
Hi.
Guess it won't be long now, huh?
Hey, hello, Joe, Mac. Guess what won't be long?
The Japs, the war, I mean.
Hey, he don't know. Didn't you hear, Charlie?
They let loose an atom bomb.
What?
Yeah, Fred Waring's program. They just busted in with a flash.
Hey, saying what?
Truman says we dropped an atom bomb on some big Jap city, Hiroshima. He says now they got their last chance to surrender.
Boy, what to do?
I guess they don't know yet what it's done. They just dropped it, Charlie.
Yes, they just dropped it. Later, another one on Nagasaki. And the boys in the restaurant were right. It wasn't going to take long for the war to end. And so they didn't talk about much else except the atom bomb during those first days.
I says, do you know what the boys are saying out in the Pacific these days? And she says, no. And I says, up and at 'em.
Why not? Let's plaster the place with those bombs and let them have it till they say uncle.
This unloosing of the forces of nature will have violent repercussions in international affairs, in domestic politics, yes, even in the everyday life of every man.
Yeah, it made you think, too. It made you think even though your hair started standing on end every time. Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Did you see those pictures? Gee, the whole place just flattened out.
Even if you go down 200 feet, maybe more, they say the stuff can still get you down there.
It's like the end of the world.
30,000 killed.
They'd make a shambles out of New York.
Anywhere, anywhere at all. It'd drop without warning.
It's like the end of the world.
Just what does happen beneath the blistering, shattering force of an atomic power bomb? To American scientists and military men walking over Hiroshima and Nagasaki several weeks after the blasts, The fact of the destruction was evident. Stories of eyewitnesses, survivors, helped piece together a visual impression of disaster. But the instruments and the trained observers were not there when the bombs went off. There was little scientific data on the bomb burst. Information gathered dealt only with the after effects.
Burns covering most of the body. Marked deterioration of white corpuscles. Frequent fainting spells.
I saw one building, steel girders twisted, masonry ground into powder. No one inside could have survived. No one did survive.
To the men charged with maintaining the armed services of these United States, the bomb immediately posed an important question. What damage would it do to warships of our fleet?
The men here at Roswell Field realized that this Nagasaki-type bomb might well be outmoded. It may be superseded by far deadlier instruments of aerial destruction. So they have nicknamed their missile the Model T bomb. You see, the boys have a good idea of what the future may produce.
That year-old bomb, already an old-fashioned Model T, has caused some 30,000 men to gather at and near Bikini Atoll. Ships and planes and men of Joint Task Force Number 1 are assigned to explode the bomb, carefully to watch the mighty blast and to study with instruments its effects upon target ships in the surrounding atmosphere.
This is Elmer Peterson at NBC in San Francisco. For the past 2 months, we have watched the ships of Joint Task Force Number 1 sail past the Golden Gate to their rendezvous at Bikini. In those months, the arguments over control of atomic secrets have grown. The question has become an official matter in the Council of the United Nations. Out at Bikini today, the bomb explosion and its results will become important material in future arguments over its control. But to Joint Task Force Number 1, the objective of Operation Crossroads is facts. Facts about destructive force against the target ship. Destruction at 1,000 yards, at 5,000 yards. Resultant disturbance in the upper air. Sphere of radioactivity, duration of radioactivity. But what is this destructive force that the Crossroads scientists will measure? Let's call upon David Dietz, the science editor for the Scripps Howard Papers.
You probably know that the atomic bomb possesses the explosive force of 20,000 tons of TNT. And perhaps you are wondering what makes it so much more powerful than ordinary explosives. I shall try to explain that for you in this broadcast. Ordinary explosives get their power from chemical reactions. Fundamentally, these are not very different from what goes on when you light a piece of coal in a fireplace. What happens in the fireplace is that the atoms of carbon combine with the atoms of oxygen from the atmosphere to form molecules of carbon dioxide. Energy in the form of heat is given off in the process, but nothing happens to the basic nature of the atoms themselves. They are still atoms of carbon and oxygen. Incidentally, the combustion of the coal is a chain reaction, for as each bit of coal burns, it heats the next bit to the point of combustion. The atomic bomb likewise depends upon a chain reaction, but it is a completely different kind of chain reaction. In this process, the atoms which form the bomb's explosive charge undergo a transformation. They split in two, and part of their mass is completely annihilated by being transformed into energy. In the year 1905, Professor Albert Einstein wrote an equation to show that under certain circumstances, matter might be transformed into energy. His equation showed that a very little matter would become a vast amount of energy. 27 years later, this equation was verified by two British scientists. But its most spectacular verification came in the atomic bomb. In the atomic bomb, a subatomic particle known as a neutron is the match that sets off the chain reaction. That first neutron causes an atom of uranium-235 or plutonium to split in half. In this process, known as nuclear fission, the atom breaks into two fragments whose total weight is slightly less than the original atom. 0.1% of the weight of the atom is lost, and that loss is transformed into energy. At the same time, two or more neutrons are released, which in their turn split more atoms. In a 10 millionth of a second, The chain reaction proceeds throughout the bomb, releasing in that tiny fraction of a second the explosive violence of 20,000 tons of TNT. And that's the atomic bomb.
So that's the atom bomb, which at this moment is riding aboard the B-29 Superfortress toward the skies above Bikini Lagoon. NBC's W.W. Chaplin stood there on Kwajalein Island this morning as the big plane roared down the runway on its historic mission.
The atom bomb is right now on its way to Bikini, perhaps already there, for the sensational scientific assault on a tethered fleet. I saw the bomb plane take off here under conditions of breathtaking drama. It was 21 minutes behind schedule because orders to start from Admiral Brandy were delayed for some reason not yet explained. Because of that delay, the drop time at Bikini has now been changed to 6 p.m. New York daylight time. At the time of the takeoff, I was broadcasting from an improvised open-air studio atop a hangar right along the runway. The big B-29 loaded at last with its fearsome cargo, taxied down from the ramp in the vague light of a clearing dawn. Red fire engines stood by, and I think we were all a little frightened. Just as Major Swankert, the pilot, gave her the gun, a rainbow shone out briefly through gray clouds, and the sun rose in splendor. 1,000 people had been evacuated from Kwajalein during the night for their safety's sake. But there were still hundreds lined along the runway. We lived a long time during the 25-second run down the airstrip. Then the plane rose slowly, it seemed laboriously, into the still air. Once over the ocean, the peril of island crash and premature burst, which would have swept us all away, that peril was gone. Gracefully, it swung northward toward Bikini, and one of man's greatest assaults on the secrets of the universe. The takeoff was at 5:54 Monday morning here, 2:54 Sunday afternoon, New York time. It should have reached the high sky over Bikini by now. Soon comes the test.
Down there on Kwajalein, some of the boys are sweating it out much as they did when our bombers flew their missions in war. These are the men of the ground crew, the fellows who keep the B-29 flying.
I am Master Sergeant John Gollinger of Alger, Ohio. I am the crew chief of atom bomb plane Dave's Dream. My job is to see that the plane is kept in commission to carry out its job. I think my mother and sister in Alger and my wife in Colton, California, will be glad to know that I have the best gang helping me that any crew chief ever had. And here they are.
I am Tech Sergeant Henry O. Smith of Hazard, Kentucky. I am assistant crew chief to the atom plane Dave's Dream. And I help Sergeant Gollinger keep it flying. My job is maintenance.
I am Staff Sergeant Logan Crump of Fort Worth, Texas. My wife and son are awaiting my return after this mission. I and my buddies on the ground crew have done everything we can, and we're sure everything will click.
I am Corporal Robert Hubbard. My mother lives in Hudson, Ohio, and my father in California. I've been with this group for months, and I found a job.
I am PFC Charles Moore of Delaware, Ohio, where my mother and father live. I'm on the maintenance crew of Major Swankert's atom bomb plane. We've been nursing that plane like a baby, and she's ready.
I am PFC Harry Taggart. My two sisters live in Sacramento, California. I was assigned to Major Swankert's crew in February in Roswell, New Mexico. I feel this thing is the biggest I've ever done in my life.
I am Private First Class George Grant. My parents live in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. My job is to keep the atom plane as clean as human hands can make it. Oil spots pick up radioactivity, so I keep that plane clean.
Today, the big news will be what happens when the bomb goes off. All the efforts of Joint Task Force 1 have been devoted to the task of tracing the path of the blast, its extent, and its violence. Not until radioactivity has disappeared can man go into the blast region. But there are ways of finding out what happens.
This is General Harvey Allen of Bayport, Minnesota. I'm the commanding officer of the Army's drone plane unit based on Eniwetok Island for the atomic bomb test. On that tiny flat-top island west of Bikini, we have trained with 10 drones, or babes as the Army calls them, and 6 motherships. The signs of the first atomic bomb test are 4 babes, radio control planes without any trays aboard, and 5 mother or control planes. They're all B-17 flying fortresses. At the direction of its mother plane, flying some 12 miles to the rear and side, each bird will fly straight into the radioactive cloud immediately after the explosion, in one side, and we hope, out the other side. The mother planes will circle around the debris cloud, pick up their babes on the other side. During that plunge through the cloud of scientific mystery, the unmanned planes will scoop up bags of radioactive air for the later inspection of scientists. And during their flight, they will report back electronically all sorts of phenomena found in that zone of mystery.
This is Colonel P.T. Cullen of San Gabriel, California. I'm commanding officer of the Army Air Force's 40 unit for the atomic bomb test at Bikini. And this is to be the most photographed event in history. In training, one of our chief problems was precision timing. That's absolutely necessary because some of our cameras only operate for 3.5 seconds. So they have to be geared very closely to the detonation of the bomb. Scientific interest in photographs of the blast centers in the first 3 seconds after the bomb bursts. All of your 300 cameras installed in Army aircraft will be operating during that period. To achieve the precision called for, we've engaged in many dress rehearsals in which able day conditions were duplicated as far as possible. In these rehearsals, we have already taken about 3.5 million photographs. Many of them were very fine pictures, and we are confident that we can record the actual blast in a satisfactory manner. There will be 8B-29s used as photographic platforms and 2 C-54s. There will, of course, also be cameras and all Army airplanes engaged in the Able Day operation, including the drone planes. The planes will circle the target at various levels for some time prior to the burst, with cameras constantly trained on the target, so we will be sure to get the detonation.
This is Philip Asoid, managing editor of Popular Science Monthly, speaking to you from the Crossroads Press Ship, Appalachian. I am now going to call one of the scientific observers who is over on another ship, the USS Panama. He is Dr. Parker Sass of Fresno, California, who teaches geology at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Sass, why is the atomic bomb of interest to geologists?
First of all, because of its effect upon problems of our carrying pattern. The bomb may jolt the atoll so much that huge masses of loose sediment may slide down the submerged sides of the atoll and set up a tidal wave.
Do you think that the bomb will set up a tidal wave, Dr. Tass?
No, I certainly do not. I would say the chances were less than the Philadelphia Athletics winning a pennant this year. I don't think that is likely, but there is still a slim chance. And the same with the tidal wave. There might possibly be one. So the geologists working for the Navy are making such a study to see just what might happen.
How did they go about making such a study?
In a most interesting way. They set off small charges of dynamite in the ground. These charges set up vibrations in the rocks underlying the atoll. And by recording the path of these vibrations through the ground, the geologists get information on the thickness of loose material that might slide down the side of the atoll below the surface of the sea.
Would they get any other information from these vibrations?
Yes. They might be able to determine whether the atoll rests upon an old volcano.
Is that of any interest to a geologist?
Well, most certainly is, because for many years there's been a great debate as to the origin of these atolls. They rise so steeply from the seafloor, from water 10 or 15,000 feet deep, that they can hardly be composed of coral all the way down. Coral will not thrive in water over 60 feet deep. Yet in one atoll, a borehole or a well went more than 1,000 feet into the atoll. It was everywhere in coral. This meant that in the last stages of growth of this atoll, the coral must have gone upward at the same rate as the sea level rose, or the sea floor sunk.
Those are some of the scientific facts to be discovered by planes, by cameras, and by soundings on the sea floor. And now, here is a message from the commander of Joint Task Force 1, Vice Admiral W.H.P. Blandy.
There have been some predictions by uninformed persons that the atomic bomb test here at Bikini will result in disaster of one kind or another. I think it's right to reassure the families of the men engaged in these experiments, or observing them, to know that every possibility of a horrible disaster that should bring thus forecast for the crossroads operation has been investigated thoroughly by scientists who know, and they are certain that no dire calamity will result. They are unanimous in their assurance that there will be no earthquake, no tidal wave, no solar action in the air or on the water, no islands pushed down and no islands pushed up. Of course, there are though the coming the explosion of an atomic bomb. Otherwise, it would never have been a weapon of war. Precautions must be taken to protect all the personnel in these tests from their dangers. A bomb can crush, burn, or render oil by radioactivity. Any persons who are close enough to it to experience these effects will explode. And radioactivity can also affect them if they venture into a heavily contaminated area too soon after the explosion. Now, of course, there are normal dangers in any operation involving large numbers of men, ships, and airplanes. Just as there's some chance of danger in driving on the highways in the United States and in traveling on the railroads or airways. But I hope I have made it clear in this brief talk that the special dangers attendant upon the explosion of the atomic bomb in the crossroads test will be minimized by draft task force one by taking every possible precaution against them. Our staff sergeant Francis Mayberry of Fort Bragg, West Virginia. If I'm not mistaken, I was one of the first GIs to report for duty with Operation Crossroads. Coming to Washington with Draft Task Force 1 from Andrews Field, Maryland in early February. So I've had a pretty good chance to see just what's going on. I'm assigned to the Army Personnel Section and assist in handling of all records for Army men on duty with Joint Task Force 1. Incidentally, I have been aboard the Mount McKinley since the ship sailed from San Francisco on May 8th. Like most of all of the other soldiers assigned to Crossroads, I'm certainly curious about the atom bomb test. One thing I'm sure of, it's going to be a very interesting and thoughtful experience. Lots of people have asked us about the safety precautions for all personnel. Well, after talking with many officers and men, I can roughly see that every conceivable precaution is being taken to ensure that no one will suffer the slightest ill effects from the explosion. I think that the other men feel exactly the same as I do on this point. We've been away from the States almost 2 months now, and I'm sure everyone is anxious to return. However, I'm equally sure that no one would want to miss seeing the big show and finding out what an atom bomb will do. Many of the soldiers here have seen the effects of ordinary bombing in both the Pacific and European theaters. But now we want to compare that with the atom bomb explosion over naval vessels. So all of us who can will be on deck watching the Big Bang. It's going to be an experience none of us will ever forget.
There in Bikini Lagoon, the ships of the guinea pig fleet await their fate. Spread in circles about the target ship Nevada are dozens of vessels of all types, deserted by their crews. Here is the reaction of one Navy man, the skipper of the aircraft carrier Saratoga.
The USS Saratoga is one of the great ships in American naval history. A little over 3 years ago, the Sarah and the USS Enterprise were the only two aircraft carriers standing between the continental United States and the Japanese Empire. Through 4 years of Pacific warfare, the Saratoga was in the thick of it. On her island are printed scores of miniature Japanese planes, one enemy aircraft carrier, and Japanese vessels of virtually every classification. Each of these critical pictures represents a victory for the Sarah and the men who manned her and the pilots who took off from her deck. The Saratoga has been damaged. Twice she was badly hurt, but she always came back to add to her victories. Like everything, the Sarah is growing old. For this reason, it was decided that she should be used as one of the target ships in the test of atomic energy against naval vessels. Despite her age, the Sarah will make an excellent target ship. She is a strong fighting ship and still able to hold her own against odds. Whether the odds of atomic energy will be too great remains to be seen. Many of my crew believe the Sarah will survive the first and second tests. Others believe the atomic bomb will be too great an adversary, especially the second atomic bomb, which will be detonated beneath the surface of Bikini Lagoon. Personally, I consider it a great honor and a real privilege to be in command of the Saratoga. My first cruise at sea as a naval aviator was aboard the Sarah as a member of Fighting Squadron 1.
the original hi-hat squadron. That was back in 1929. Little did I think then that I would be her commanding officer when she dropped anchor in Bikini Lagoon to meet the mysterious powers of atomic energy. I will not venture an opinion as to the atomic fate of the Saratoga, but I do know that if she survives, it will be one of the greatest moments of my life to take her back to San Francisco and sail her under the Golden Gate.
The bomb that is on the way to Bikini Lagoon at this moment will tell whether the Saratoga does someday sail again through the Golden Gate. Until our next report from Operations Crossroads, the NBC staff with Joint Task Force Number 1 is standing by.
On the subject of the bomb test at Bikini, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John suggesting that you remain tuned to the NBC station to which you are now listening for the dramatic broadcasts which we expect to bring you very soon directly from Kwajalein Island and from Bikini Atoll as the atom bomb is dropped. Robert St. John in New York City. We have been bringing you a broadcast directly from San Francisco, from Kwajalein Island, from the scene of one of the most historic events that will have taken place in your lifetime and mine. Rarely in days of peace do we have as dramatic a story to unfold to you by radio as the one we are unfolding to you this afternoon. Last Sunday, you heard over the National Hour a preliminary broadcast. Today, in the last half hour, we have been bringing you the prelude to the event which is going to take place in about 1.5 hours. At about 6 o'clock New York time, 5 o'clock Chicago time. And so now we leave you, but we invite you to remain tuned to your NBC station.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and San Francisco, and by shortwave broadcasts recorded from the Pacific, we have brought you the 33rd of these programs on national problems and current affairs. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Elmer Peterson reporting from San Francisco, and W.W. Chaplin, Ralph Howard Peterson, George Thomas Folster reporting from Operation Crossroads. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.